tonight, we're incredibly honored to have Dana Spiotta, whose most recent novel is Stone Arabia, in conversation with Edward Champion. Edward Champion is a writer and critic and host of the Bat Segundo Show. And Dana Spiotta is the author of Eat the Document, which was nominated for a National Book Award. Her first novel, Lightning... Spiotta, excuse me for mingling.
That's okay.
her first novel, Lightning Field, was a Los Angeles Times Best Book of the West and a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. She has received a Guggenheim Fellowship and both the Rome Prize and the Rosenthal Foundation Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She teaches in the MFA program at Syracuse University, and we're very honored to have her here. Let's welcome both writers.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to this wonderful audience who came out on a rather hot and humid day. This is going to be great.
So you can hear me. Okay.
Oh, yeah. You can hear me. We can hear each other.
Yes.
Fantastic. I'm very honored to talk with Dana. I've loved all of her books, and this third one is also marvelous. And I think I want to start by kind of going for a thematic approach here, because I have noticed that all of your novels are guided by having some imposter who is at the center of the narrative. And I'm curious if that notion of an imposter being sort of a prism with which to view American society and American culture, what is up with that? I mean, we're now in an age where, thanks to the internet, which aids and abets thousands of Don Quixotes that unleash every second. I mean, this is something that Cervantes could never have even seen in the early 17th century. What motivates your interest in imposters, especially in this, and maybe we can use this to talk about the lovely Nick Wirth, who is a wonderful imposter.
I think the word I would use instead of imposter is people that have secret lives, maybe, mm-hmm. is another way of putting it. And I do see that all in all three books there are people with secret lives. I mean, Nick Wirth's the character in this book, he's not trying to make it a secret, you know. I mean, nobody's really that interested, but he's definitely an eccentric person, and has a double life to a certain extent. One, he has a fictional career and his actual life, and they are somewhat at odds with each other, and then in other ways they overlap. Clearly it's something I'm interested in, but I think to a certain extent we all have those double lives and triple lives, and the part of me who writes novels is different from the part of me who's speaking today, and so I think it is an exaggerated version of what we do all the time, and certainly the internet is amplifying that, sure.
Yes, mm-hmm. But I mean, characters who hide in plain sight.
Right.
You know, I think maybe that might be a better way to identify this common theme. Is this really the role of the 21st century novelist? I hesitate to use a term like post-realist.
Right.
But it is interesting that there is this balance between what is real and what is fake. You have Casa Real. You have the fakes, the band name in this. So it's very very pronounced here. And I'm wondering if a novelist today is almost obligated to respond to this Pandora's box, so to speak.
Sure. I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, most... I always feel that I have a kind of... This kind of doubleness is natural for me. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's because I sit in a room and I make up people, and that's kind of a strange thing to do. But so I imagine everybody does this, and maybe that's not true, but I sort of think of everyone as having multiple selves. And this is just a more amplified version.
Versions of Me, one of the songs that Nick Wirth actually is responsible for. Nick's Chronicles. There is in this book a very lengthy multi-volume set where Nick Wirth, this character, is fabricating selves of all sorts. You have critics. He's writing critical reviews of his own work. He is doing parodies and pastiches of his family members. I'm curious because there's a lot of specific artistic and musical references both within Nick's Chronicles and also your book. The fake Denise letter that Denise reads at the very beginning is almost a trick on Denise. How do you write something this true without it actually seeming like a trick for the reader? I mean, are you thinking more in terms of how Denise is feeling? Because Denise is responding to these chronicles, so.
Right, so it's an interesting question because in the book there are people, in the chronicles, one character is writing, pretending to be another character, and then you're reading that, and how does that not just seem sort of manipulative and silly?
Yeah.
And I think that the key is that there has to be something that's you have to inhabit that character inhabiting that other character, and you have to make Nick pretty good at what he does.
Yes.
He has to sort of be a novelist.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just an extra layer. And so in a way, I guess it sort of comments on the whole idea of the artifice of creating a novel and a character. But mostly I think it's really about his affection for his sister and sort of his poking her a bit at the same time. So, I mean, so much about this book, what I really wanted the book to be is anchored in the emotional reality of a family and a brother and sister and their as they age and how the decisions they made about themselves when they were 25, what does that feel like 25 years later? So you have someone who says, I want to be an artist and I'm going to be an artist no matter what. I don't care if anybody likes my work. And that's easy to say when you're 19. But then 25 years later, what does that look like? What does it feel like? And then what does it feel like for the people around you? And so Nick is a kind of dramatic version of that. And he has this other layer of this invented life that he does for his amusement and for his, and I think to keep his sanity to a certain extent, to give him, so he makes up his own audience, he makes up his own response, he's in dialogue with himself. So I wanted to pull that out, but always keep it anchored in the emotional truth of a brother and sister and the family.
Is the family really the best way to anchor that emotional truth? I mean, this also concerns memory, this concerns context, this concerns fact versus fiction. I mean, did everything originate from the family? Or how did these little sort of, I suppose, side quests come about?
Okay, so I think... What my envision for the book was to have it be very intimate and claustrophobic and sort of distorted by emotion and subjectivity and to be this intimate thing. And I think that to the extent that your family, all those things do tie back because one of the concerns of the book is how do you retain yourself in the face of, let's say, all these things that want to annihilate you, and not just the internet and information and all the things come at you, but also just that you're aging and you're watching your parents age and you're eventually going to die and all the things that we all have to deal with. How do you retain your sense of self? And part of it is your memory, and part of it is the things you've created to protect yourself. Like Nick has his retreat, and it's a way of protecting himself. But then also it's the people in your life who tell you who you are to a certain extent, and that can be a kind of, that can trap you, but it also can save you.
Yeah.
And it's both things at once. And I'm always interested in things being both, more than one thing,
yeah.
Not either or, but this and this. And they're often, I don't think of it as sort of being ambivalence. I think of it as being feeling strongly about things in two ways. And that's sort of always the case in my books, that things are going to be in multiples. They're not just going to be, yeah, family's great, or family is a burden. It's both of these things are very closely tied together.
Well, with Denise, she is the exclusive audience pretty much for
right.
Nick's work, for the Anthology of Worth, this
right.
20-album cycle that he's producing, and also for the Chronicles. Is this artistic response, this duty to look at her brother's projects and his art, something of a familial obligation? Or?
Well, I think she gets something out of it, and
yeah.
Part of what she feels is protection for her brother, and part of what he feels is protection for her, too. And I think one of the things the book's also interested in is this idea of response. So there's something of that you've created, and then there's a response. And in this case, it's more interactive than in the usual case. But as a, you know, I relate to her as a responder, as someone who's as an audience, because I mean, that's part of her salvation is that she's able to respond to things and engage them deeply. And you know, so I think they both, it's very tied together,
sure.
I think. And I think that's why the book, when you get toward the end, where I don't want to you know, it's not a thriller. I'm going to spoil anything. But when you get to the end, it kind of ends on a memory, and this moment where Denise is really experiencing some music, not her brother's music, just some random music that's on the turntable. And there's a kind of contained within it is this sort of desire and hope and this idea about the future and idea about who you can be. And I wanted to really end with that sort of youthful longing after what you see that's gone, how their lives ended up. Yeah.
I want to talk briefly about writing process. You've said that you like to work on things that you haven't figured out, but when you're writing on something like this, especially a multi-layered, complicated novel, your subconscious muse is going to lead you down certain rabbit holes and possibly into areas of semi-familiarity. So I'm wondering how this works. If you're somewhat familiar or even entirely familiar with something, perhaps you find out about this later, is it really a matter of attacking a subject or a topic with a barrage of inquiry or a barrage of questions? Is this kind of how things work when you're working on a novel? Or?
Well, I mean, I guess what Ed's referring to is that I said that, you know, people want to know what's the book about? What are you trying to get across, you know? And I really, and it's a natural thing to want to know. But what I'm really interested in is just sort of, I start with this thing that I don't really understand. What I described, this idea of continuing work in isolation and sort of what that would feel like down the road. Because I had so many people in my life who do this and are pursuing things. And I find it, is there a purity to it? Or is it a solipsism? Or is it both? Then I get into it, and what I find is that the question just becomes more and more complicated. And then the whole idea of consciousness and this narrator, who's the sister, and how she's processing things. And then other things start popping up. Her relationship to media, her relationship to the internet, her relationship to her mother, who's losing her memory. And then I think, well, what does memory have to do with it? So it's kind of a constantly moving forward and discovering things. And what I find is that, that I think an interesting thing for the novel to do is to enact a kind of complexity that's maybe absent in other places. It shouldn't be reducible to something that you can kind of put in a sentence. And what's nice about Nick Worth, and I think about this now, is that when I'm out talking about the book and I find it so challenging in some ways, I'm so grateful to have people listening and all of that. But I also admire the fact that he doesn't ever have to do that.
He doesn't ever
have to explain anything. And he doesn't ever have to kind of, you know, bring it down to a little nub. And you want it to sort of resonate. So when people end the book, they're like, oh, now I know. Done with that. You want it to be, what is that? Oh, okay. And, you know, so I kind of want people to have a kind of uneasy finish. Feel satisfied that it's ended. I'm not saying you shouldn't feel satisfied and feel complete, but I do want it to sort of resonate beyond the last page, and you have to leave a kind of open-endedness, I think, for that to happen.
Yeah.
And then talking about it always sounds kind of reductive and silly
certainly,
a little bit,
certainly.
You know.
How do you deal with this? I mean, on one level, you have to sort of be explicit and clear about your details, and the prose is often very clear. On another level, you can't entirely give away your game. You need to actually have this open-endedness with which you just speak about. So what do you do when you just want to gab? You know, what do you want when you just want to hang out? Is it a constant idea of refraining from?
Yeah, I mean, on revision, to revision, I cut out a lot of stuff that's connective tissue that seems too explicit to me.
Yeah,
I mean, that often you don't need that. So in revision, I do take what you sort of think of it as. There's something holding everything up, and you think you need it for so long, and then eventually, with enough, if you've looked at it fresh, you see that you don't need those things, and you pull them out. And it's always better to take out more.
Well, can you spill some of the goods? What did you leave out? Nothing? Okay. Not even like a pony or anything? Okay. From the section you're going to read tonight, at one point Denise writes, "Every time we take a photograph, we forget to embed things in our minds and our actual brain cells." Denise is clearly aware of the way that humans sort of swap memory and tangible evidence for another medium.
Right.
But it is interesting. It reminded me to some degree of Susan Sontag's Regarding the Torture of Others, but I'm wondering why Denise can't be entirely alive sometimes without these artifacts. Is it now sort of the 21st century mode? What of this?
Well, I think that she's in a crisis point. Yeah. You know, this novel starts with her. So, you know, many years have gone by and everything's sort of held together. And the novel begins when everything's falling apart.
Yeah.
And so all the things, the ability to take care of her mother, the ability to deal with her brother, her daughter, and then her own self. So I think she's extremely vulnerable to outside things. And so she becomes... So I don't think she's alive when she experiences them. I think she's actually being annihilated by them because she doesn't have an answer. She doesn't have any way to respond. She doesn't have any way to process it. She's overwhelmed. And so I think part of the book is if, you know, how does she manage these? How does she come out? You know, is she going to be okay in some way? How is she going to cope with all of this? And so that's something I was interested in too.
Yeah.
How do you deal with, I mean, she has this thing where she watches a lot of, television, and she goes on the internet a lot, and she's overwhelmed by information. I know none of you have ever experienced it. And it's just, it does it to an extent that she feels it annihilates herself and doesn't give her, she feels emotions for things on, that are borrowed and false and manipulative and not for the people in her life who are actually suffering. And she doesn't do anything about it. She doesn't go out and help people or anything like that. She just sort of sits there and cries and is overwhelmed. So it's not a good place to be. And I do think that one of the things the book is interested in is what's the difference between information and art. You know, Nick, to a certain extent, creates something and orders it and shapes it. And he sort of has, you know, he protects himself in that way. And to the extent that her consciousness is engaged in the world, she's braver than he is. But is she able to get a handle on it? Is she able to sort of make her way and answer back in some sense and keep herself safe? And be a human.
Well, she's also precluded by this notion of having to take in so much art from her brother, so it's almost a full-time obligation. On the other hand, she's also very good at looking up the physician's desk reference and the WebMD style site, that this is her reference point, this information. I mean, is it sort of your suggestion with this character that information becomes everything for her, even down to, like, you know, checking her brother's gout problem, you know?
I think it's an illusion that it's going to save her, but she can't, she's compelled anyway, I think. So I definitely still think it's it's not a sustaining thing.
Stylistically, I feel compelled to point out that the wonderful somewhat transcript, somewhat Hollywood script that was employed in Lightning Field makes a comeback here.
I knew you were going
to ask. Yes, I had to. I'm curious how this stylistic format developed. Does it create almost a set of limitations when you need to work out a character problem? Or how, what of this?
So he's describing, I have a script format in the book.
I think there's
We could even show there's them. A couple reasons for that. I mean, there's a movie in the book. There's a documentary that's so there's multiple so there's different things going on. There's the chronicles which Nick makes, and then there's Denise sort of counter chronicle. Well, it's called a counter chronicle. It's not sort of. It actually is. And then there's Denise's daughter Ada's making a documentary, and there are pieces of the documentary in there. And partially, it's just simply to distinguish that this is a movie and this is not a movie in the book, in the world. I mean, you know, so it's there to show you that it's a movie. But I have to admit, I think one of the reasons why I'm interested, I mean, I love movies, and so that's why I write about them. I'm interested in writing about other kinds of art in a novel. I like describing movies. I like describing music. I think this is compelling to me. But also, I think another reason why I like it is I kind of get sick of the dialogue tags, he said, she said, and these little, the conventions of fiction, where I sometimes just like that name and then what they said, name and then what they said. I love dialogue, and I don't like the dialogue tags, but I also don't like to get confused about who's speaking. So maybe novelists should just give up that and just do the script format.
Well,
and you don't need that part, like, oh, and he put his hand in his hair, and then he said, you know, just...
Maybe. Well, one thing that's real I like about this format is there are all these digressions that really, if this was turned into an intelligence agency, they would ask for a rewrite. So it allows, I think, both the stripping of the he said, she said, but also it allows us into the consciousness of these characters in a way that perhaps, I suppose, regular prose does not. Is this one of the advantages?
Maybe. I mean, you kind of come at it at all angles.
Yeah, okay. Well, actually, why don't we have you read?
Okay.
So that people know what we're talking about here. Okay. And then after that, we'll open the floor for questions. So.
Okay, I'm just going to read a 10-minute section, and then you have any questions. I think this is going to work. Okay. So, to set this up, it's just Denise, the sister, has been to visit her mother. And her mother has the beginning of dementia. She's losing her memory. And while she's at her mother's house, it's her birthday. It's Denise's birthday. And her mother has mentioned this birthday cake that she made for her when she was 14. And Denise had forgotten about it. And she remembers the birthday cake. And they have this moment. And then she leaves. And the only other thing I want to say about the section is she's forgotten something. If you know what it is she's forgotten, don't say anything, okay? That's what I want to tell you, because you spoil it for the other people. So it's okay if it's about dementia, but you can still laugh, okay? Because nothing's funnier than dementia. Okay, so this is really loud. Wait, sorry. Let's see if I'm going to start. Okay. I left her apartment, sniffling and congested with my little birthday pirouettes around mortality. A fitting birthday disposition, but then I began to fixate on how I had managed to forget that birthday cake. I realized I couldn't actually locate it in my memory. I could remember only the photograph we took of the cake, not the feel of the pink and white frosting in my mouth, not the gulp of cold milk I no doubt drank after a few bites. Oh, sure, I could conjure a sweet cake taste memory, but that was a generic substitute. A little made-up game. All that remains is a photo of that cake somewhere in some album. It does not help having a photo. Every time we take a photograph, we forget to embed things in our minds, in our actual brain cells. The taking of the photograph gets us off the hook, in a way, from trying to remember. I'll take a photo so I can remember this moment. But what you are really doing is leaving it out of your brain's jurisdiction and relying on Polaroids, Kodak paper, little disintegrating squares glued in albums, easily lost or neglected in a box in your waterlogged garage, or you bury it in some huge digital file waiting to be clicked open. All you have done is postpone the looking, and so the actual engaging, until all you are left with is this second-generation memory, a memory of an event that is truly only a memory of a photograph of the event. It is not a real deep memory, it is a fake fleeting one, and your mind can't even tell the difference. These very ordinary memory failings gathered weight and had grown into a quiet but desperate obsession over the last few months. I started to take note of them right after we finally got my mother's official diagnosis. The official diagnosis. Her doctor said she had age-related cognitive decline, also called mild cognitive impairment, very common for a person in her 70s, and that this was no longer called senility, which really just means oldness. Eventually, it will probably become mild dementia and then full-blown dementia, which is a kind of scary-sounding word which simply means the mind is going away. So you have to specify age-related dementia instead of, say, drug-induced dementia. My mother exhibited significant early symptoms of age-related dementia, including, but not limited to, advancing episodic memory impairment and disorientation. Very commonplace, he said, which is supposed to be a comfort. When pressed, he also remarked that her decline was most certainly progressive. But everything was progressive, clearly. Did we actually think our memory had any stasis? That it wasn't constantly melting away? After that, I began to find her troubling to be around for all the obvious emotional reasons. But I also had a growing worry that her lapses were somehow contagious. I had no rational basis for this anxiety. Clearly, her brain was distinct from my own brain. I also knew I was probably avoiding a more frightening mortal anxiety by substituting a slightly more manageable one. But the traffic was gone now. I still had a 45-minute commute to work. I didn't have the heart to listen to the memory book, the self-help book. I pretended I bought the stupid book to help my mother, but I knew I was really buying it to appease my paranoia about my own mental deterioration. Maybe just owning it would be enough, and I wouldn't actually have to listen to it. Then, out of nowhere, randomly, I had a memory crisis, a mental meltdown over a seemingly insignificant piece of information that I tried to recall. I don't know what led me to try and retrieve this particular piece of trivia, because I don't remember. But there I was, floundering as I drove, sweating even, chewing hard on an herbal, soon-to-be flavorless piece of gum. This sort of memory slip was all too typical of my brain these days. Sometimes basic words of familiar vocabulary hid behind missing letters. I would run through the alphabet, hoping I would get the right sound by process of elimination. More often, a name I knew refused to come to me. I constantly had the sense of information on the verge, precision at the margin, vision just beyond the frame. Not like Mom, not remembering what I was trying to remember. This was not remembering what I sort of nearly recalled. It was like a glitch, like a scratch on a record. I even hit my head occasionally to get the needle to jump to the next place. I knew somehow moving forward was often the best way to remember what came before. Looking at a thing directly didn't work. I also knew trying so hard just caused surges of stress-induced cortisol to shut down my hippocampus, sealing off access to my long-term memory. Still, this time I was trying to think of a movie actress's name. I came up with Mamie Van Doren. And I knew that was not who I was trying to think of. I was trying to think of another blonde actress, one much more famous than Mamie Van Doren. I thought about her, this actress with the out-of-reach name, and how she was decapitated in a tragic Cadillac accident. I thought of her famous custom-made heart-shaped swimming pool. Yes, anyone would have it now, but not me. Marilyn Monroe was at the other end of the bombshell spectrum. This actress was ersatz Marilyn, and Mamie Van Doren was ersatz her, ersatz. I saw her face, her little nose, her chalky pink lips, her enormous breasts. Enormous in the old way, fleshy mounds that attached to the whole chest, Anita Ekberg oceanic flesh that might drown a man, instead of the modern style augmented separate two high globes with a huge lonely valley between them. Carved breasts that seem to exist almost in a different world from the body they are attached to. But how could I assess the pertinent advantages of real versus fake enormous breasts? Maybe men like that hard valley. Maybe they like the delineated order of the implanted artificial breasts. I could not think of her name. My mother would get that vague, anxious look as she realized she was searching for something that wasn't there, and then she would forget it, the forgetting, and move on. She just let things go without a fight, and then she was on to the next thing waiting to be forgotten. I could not let go. I started to talk out loud. I shouted, "What the hell is her name?" Sending the now flavorless gum flying out of my mouth. I retrieved the gum with the tissue as I tried not to swerve the car. And then I began to recite the outlines of the memory as if I were pleading a case to the dementia police. I can't be losing my memory because I can think of Mamie Van Doren. I can think of the breasts of this poor unnamed actress. I can think of her method of death, for God's sakes. I can think of a stupid movie she was in with Tom Yule. I can think of Tom Yule. I have clearly an excellent memory. It was merely a glitch. Then I try to do some lateral move to think of something else, but really, moving on when you were more or less still assigning a portion of your brain to this elusive memory task, it fooled no one. Ada would say, "Just look it up, Mom." But that was easy for her and her young, elastic, fearless brain. I wouldn't look it up on the Internet Movie Database or Wikipedia or anywhere else. Ada doesn't understand why I need to remember every random piece of nonsense. It is almost as if she believes the internet will be her memory. I want to warn her, I've been through this with photographs, it just isn't the same as actually remembering. I see her point about cluttering your brain with easily looked up trivia, but there are other things I need to remember, things not found on Wikipedia. I want to remember my mother before she was sick, I want to remember what Ada smelled like when she was a baby, and I want to remember when I began to suspect things weren't okay with Nick. I want some accounting for my own behavior, and I want the future to have some clarity. I need my memory for all of that to occur. That is why incidents like this one were so critical. If I couldn't think on my own of this actress's name, I had no hope for any of the rest of it. So I used calm focus. I inhaled and exhaled. I was so close, I felt it. It was almost there. It was like a brain orgasm. The anticipatory sensation I was feeling, a kind of building. Then I got Anna Nicole Smith. And I couldn't stop thinking of her hard little eyes and her little doll nose and the same chalky pink lipstick. But it wasn't Anna Nicole Smith, of course. And now I was stuck again, the closeness receding. I had a name, Mamie Van Doren, and a face, the pudgy, pretty face of Anna Nicole Smith. But I was further than ever from my actress. In fact, I had to keep pushing these other people off my mind. The only way out of this very frustrating trap was to look it up. Defeat, yes, but peace. I took another deep breath. Damn it, okay. One last recap. Tom Ewell, Cadillac, decapitated, pool, lips, breasts. Then I saw it, the book with the black and white photos. Yes, the picture of her and her breasts. Yes, closer, yes. No Mamie, no Marilyn, no Anna, no, but man, yes, yes, man. I could see the covered stretcher in the photos that she's taken from the scene of Jane Mansfield, Jane Mansfield, Jane goddamn Mansfield. Yes, yes, yes. So there, happy birthday. It was in there somewhere, all of it. Memory of a photo of a woman, an index in synapses and dendrites, a name.
Thank you.
Okay, so before I open the floor, I have to ask, the memory techniques, Calm Focus, which you just read,
right,
were they taken from any real life memory techniques, or did you completely devise them? And if you did,
they work.
Okay, so this is the alternative if things don't work anyway. Okay,
absolutely. Okay, so
do we have questions from the audience? Questions, anybody?
Don't be shy.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And then there's these parts that interrupt where it's just narration.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no counter chronicles.
Right.
Some enables
narrative. Well, the novel starts out in the third person, and then these documents appear. There's the counter chronicles, which is Denise's first person. And then Nick, he writes in the third person, but it's him. And then there's Ada's script. So I tried to make all of those sections distinct. And so I wanted to have that third person narrator come in and remind you that you're in the middle, because the Counter Chronicles is such a big document that I wanted to interrupt and remind you that this is a written thing. Because part of what she's struggling with is putting is this kind of how to find the words to describe. It almost seems as if she's going to figure it out if she can get the language right to a certain extent, which is sort of what every novelist sort of secretly thinks is true, right? So that's kind of playing with that a little bit, but I wanted to always keep the organizing principles coherent. So that was really why that was there. When I'm in the third person, I'm always very close to Denise's consciousness. The whole novel is really through her consciousness. It, whether it's direct when she's writing her own document, which is that first person, but even when it's in the third person, when it's that she, it's very close to her consciousness. We get her interior thoughts. It sometimes goes into her interior thoughts because I really wanted her to be the thread, her mind to be the thread through the whole novel. So I wanted to be able to distinguish between these things. You only see Ada and Nick's stuff when Denise is looking at it, really. So she's sort of the organizing consciousness of the book. So I wanted to keep that integrity. But I also wanted to distinguish between the different parts of it. Does that make sense? Yes?
How does the tiny stone Arabia connect to the book?
Well, it's a good question. It's a question I already asked about stone Arabia. And the thing is that I can't really tell you, I have to let you read it, because I don't want to spoil the book for you. It is a place where something important happens. And that's pretty much what I want to say about it. Anne Elizabeth was my aunt. It does. It's a little town in upstate New York. A beautiful, beautiful, almost magical place that I find very overwhelming. My friend Eric knows about it. He's smiling at me. It's a beautiful place, right? It's a gorgeous place, yeah.
But it's just to jump off of this, its roots in certain history. This was considered when you thought about Stone Arabia.
I think it has some interesting mystique to it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I like the way it sounds. I think it sounds nice. It's sort of, when you read it, you'll see, when you get to that part, maybe you'll see, I hope you'll see why I called it that. Someone else had a question. Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I started the book.
Okay.
And the passage in the early part is about how one finds refuge in hyperarticulateness. I thought it was just heartbreaking and true and really perceptive, very moving for me.
Thank you.
And the result of that was I began to think about rock and roll as the opposite end of hyperconnecting, hyperarticulateness, because you can't be hyperarticulate and express rock and roll. I'm very interested in your thoughts and feelings on hyperarticulateness as a refuge and rock and roll as a refuge.
Well, it's kind of it's an interesting question about, it's interesting because I think that that one of the things that happens in the book too is that this idea that hyperarticulateness is going to help you isn't really true. Just also that memory is not going to save you either. And that as she realizes that her mother's losing her memory, she realizes that that there are things that reside in the body that exists overall, that that who you are is not, you're not going to lose everything that you are, because we sort of think we're our memories, and we are to a certain extent. But I think, so I think that, that all of these things that we do to retain our sense of ourself are sort of illusory and fragile and falling apart. So I think that that there is a kind of a physical urgency that's over here, and there's this kind of intellectual process over here, and these are all these things that we cobble together to sort of keep ourselves whole. I know that's probably not really answering your question. Okay. Yes.
So Nick's a musician, and I found myself really fascinated by all his projects. I wanted to be a fan.
Okay. Good.
I'm thinking, you reminded me of some musicians, like cult musicians.
Right.
And we really only get this sense that he's good from Denise.
So right. So is he good? You're asking me, is he good?
And if he is, why didn't he, or why isn't he discovered?
Okay, so, well, lots of good people don't get discovered. We know that, right? Okay. So, but I guess the question isn't, I guess it doesn't matter if he's good. I guess what matters is that his devotion is what I was interested in. And I wanted to leave to you to get precisely that question off of your mind. I mean, I think that his, I think it's beside the point for who he is. It's because he's taken, he doesn't want to know whether you think he's good or not. He just wants to do it. For him, it works. And for Denise, it works. And the rest of it doesn't matter. So, I mean, I guess it's sort of like this romantic idea that just the doing it is the important part, and the evaluation is maybe not as important.
Well, just to jump in on that, there is a point where Denise says, hey, they might make a documentary of you when right. you're 50. And so this raises an interesting ethical choice about, well, if you support the arts, are you contributing to something positively, or are you leading him down the wrong path? Or does it matter, the right or wrong path? It's a very interesting question your book raises. What of this? I mean, you've said that he's not insane, that he's a valid artist, and I'm really curious about this issue.
Adam?
Oh, okay. Well, leave it to the reader. Okay, another question?
Anybody else have a question? Yeah.
I wanted to get into a little bit about the relationship between what presented the characters and information. I mean, Ed brought this up with Denise being obsessed with WebMD. She also, like, watches the news a lot.
Right.
Brave. And, of course, by being, Nick's primary audience, in a way, she's kind of controlling the flow of information. She's also controlling the flow of information that we, the readers,
right.
get.
So sorry, I didn't mean to shout.
What is your sort of sense of what you're trying to do with respect to information, especially because you set the book in 2004, when it almost predates, we had an information explosion thanks to the internet, but
right.
It's 2011, it's like exponentially more crazy.
It's a pre-Facebook age, yeah.
Yeah, pre-Facebook age. How did we live? to get to this idea, I'm just going to talk about the 2004 thing for a second. I mean, I was interested in, I wanted it to be this year. I thought of that as just a terrible year, a year in which everything just got so much worse. And so that was very appealing to me for the news aspect of it. I had all these news events that I wanted to be. I mean, it's so weird because when you make a book, you can make up so much, but then other things have to sort of adhere to reality. And one of the things I wanted was what she was seeing on TV to actually be on TV. So I wanted to have those news events to be significant and interesting. And it was the year of George Bush's reelection. And it was the year that, it seemed like an important place to start. So I think it wasn't deliberately to exclude Facebook, but but now that I think about it, I like that idea. I think her relationship to this information is illusory. It feels like you're gaining power. It feels like you're getting somewhere, but it's really the opposite, because there isn't. It's not constructed and organized. And moreover, it's sort of, Nick's got an organizing principle which is interesting and has integrity and has vision, even if it's not good. But the internet does not have that. No one is curating it for you. In fact, the only curating principle is commerce, is monetization. It's moving you toward something. You're skeptical, but it's true. And so I think that the illusion of endless amounts of information as being liberating or releasing you, I think has an enormous cost. So that's partially what I was interested in. I'm not saying it's bad. It has other things too. And just that part of it, I think, can be overwhelming. Yeah.
After I left for college.
Uh-huh.
Like, her mother was going through Alzheimer's.
Right. Wow.
It's this kind of like maternal.
Yes.
Emotion and panic.
Yes.
I always felt it made me feel sad when I would talk to her on the phone and she'd be like, well, there was this hurricane.
Right. Yep.
I reacted so strongly to that. And then hearing you describe it in kind of a pathetic way, like, made me sad.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I do think there's that she does take care of everyone, and and it makes her more vulnerable to feeling too much. Yeah, it's true.
We haven't even brought up Denise's daughter, who's also a blogger, who turns into a documentary filmmaker, and then becomes this person who is shooting a documentary of Nick Wirth. Is this your sort of effort to tie this in generationally, or describe? I wonder if you can sort of elaborate on that.
I think she's another. I think she has her own strategy for retaining her selfhood. I think she's more equipped to deal with things than her mother or her uncle in some ways.
I'm curious about your influences. One of the reviewers in the Times mentioned DeLillo as and a visible influence on your very early work and your development now. And I'm curious about how you navigate your influences and who they are and how they enrich you and how they inhibit you. Okay.
I'm a great admirer of DeLillo's. I think most serious youngish writers are. I don't worry about it. I just do, it's just so distorted by my own weirdness that it takes care of itself. I couldn't do what he does if I tried, and that's good. I just do my own weird thing. But I definitely, I was really inspired and am still inspired, and watching his and reading his work has been enormously powerful to me as an artist, absolutely. And still feels that way. Any other questions?
I think that's it.
Yes.
Where can I get old DVDs or VHSs of the KO?
That's not a real show. That's not a real show. It was kind of inspired. You remember that show? You won't remember this. There was, I think it was called Walking Tall or something. With like, I think it had Leif Garrett or somebody was like that in it. Yeah. So yeah, you're joking, but very good.
Any additional questions? Anyone in the back? Or? Okay. All right. Well,
Thank you so much.